Today's Teisho will be on case 16 in the Pienlu, in the Heikigan Roku. Case 16, Kyosei's instruction on pecking and tapping. Engo's introduction. There is no byroad to the way. There one stands absolutely firm. The Dharma transcends seeing and hearing. There one is independent of words and thoughts. If you make your way through all the thorny entanglements, break down the barriers of the Buddha and the patriarchs, and attain the quiet and secret land, there heaven will find no way to send flowers to you, and the devil no way to spy you out. All day long you act without acting, speak without speaking. Then you have learned to tap the eggshell at the moment the chick is emerging, to wield the death-dealing sword that also gives life. However, going still further, when you realize in your activity along the constructive route how to grasp the student on the one hand and release him on the other, you will deserve to be called a teacher. But in the realm of the absolute, things will become different. Now, how will it be with the matter of the absolute? See the following. Main subject. A monk said to Kyosei, I want to peck from the inside. Would you please tap from the outside? Kyosei said, could you attain life or not? The monk said, if I could not attain life, I would be a laughingstock. Kyosei said, you too are a fellow in the weeds. Old Buddha had his way of teaching. The monks answer one no praise. Strangers to each other, hen and chick. Who can peck when the tapping comes? Outside the tap was given, inside the chick remained. Once again the tap was given. Monks throughout the world attempt the trick in vain. I want to thank everybody for doing a wonderful job again this morning, and also yesterday. People have been coming into Dokusan, and it's just wonderful and deeply exciting to see everybody doing such an outstanding job with their practice. There's not a single person in this room who hasn't made an excellent effort. An excellent effort. I can't tell you how happy I am and how grateful I am. You know, I care deeply about Zen. It's what I think about when I go to bed. It's what I think about when I wake up. It's what I think about during the day. I sit in the evening. I sit in the morning. There's really not a place for me to sit at lunch, you know. But the thing is, it's the core of my life, and so I'm very happy to meet people who are interested in walking this path, and I'm thrilled to meet people who are practicing so wholeheartedly. Everybody's really sitting on the cushion. And coming into the Dokusan room and presenting excellent answers. We don't always know that we're presenting excellent answers. You know, we often have an image of how things are supposed to be. This is quite a problem, you know. I myself, when I got started with Zen, I had already read some books on Buddhism. And I had ideas about what was going to happen on the cushion. And I had gotten these ideas from all kinds of crazy places, you know, but including books on Zen by D.T. Suzuki, the great Japanese author. And Suzuki will, he writes about Zen masters having Daikensho experiences and, you know, slapping each other in the face and jumping out a window, you know, really putting their shoes on their head and, you know, walking out backwards and, you know, and you just think, wow, that sounds so cool, you know. And also, you know, I come from a Western, tradition, so I had a lot of ideas from mysticism. So, you know, I imagined that, I would be, you know, I didn't think I'd be lifted up by angels, but I thought that there would be some kind of a big, you know, the sky would open up and a big beam of light would come down and hit me in the forehead. And so I was expecting those kinds of experiences, you know. And when I started practicing with Genki Roshi, I really wanted to have some big Kensho type experiences. They didn't come, you know, they didn't come. I went in to see Genki Roshi. The first time I met him, I was, I love Genki Roshi even now. And I mean, I love him all these years. When I first met him, you know, I could barely speak because he just, it was like, my God, a Zen master, you know, how amazing, you know. And I'd read these books about Zen masters who, you know, jump out the window and stuff like that. So I just thought, my God, this is like a creature from another planet, you know. And so anyway, he gave me, he said, okay, well, you know, your koan is a susoku-kan, which is breath perception. And, what's that? He said, well, you know, just breathe through your hara, your dantian, and watch your breath. And, you know, I was disappointed. I have to say, I went back, you know, I just thought, well, this is no good. This is like for babies. You know, this is like a, you know, beginner's koan, you know. I thought, well, there's nothing to this, you know, and I squeeze your hara, the breath goes out, you watch the breath, big deal, you know, and I wanted to have like this super duper experience, you know, I would go in to see the Roshi, the teacher, the Shifu, I would try to give him profound answers. You know, I something like, you know, life is death and death is life, you know. It's all the world in a breath, you know, this kind of thing. And some of this wasn't really phony, you know, I wasn't being a phony. It sounds ridiculous. I've talked about the fact I brought in a flower, rock, you know, sandwich, stuff like that. And I was trying to figure out how to, you know, I didn't know that there's another way to relate to the world other than with my intellect, you know, with my English student's mind, you know, my English major's mind. So, you know, I kept trying to be poetic or philosophically profound, and Genki just kept, you know, in classical Zen, the teacher has a little bell, and so when you come in and you do Dokusan, you sit down in front of the teacher, and the teacher at some point will terminate the interview and by ringing a bell. Sometimes, in my case, it often happens very fast. You know. I get in here and just like, nothing's going on here, ding, ding. You know. I couldn't figure it out. I couldn't find this other way, of experiencing the world, because I just knew about complexity, right? I just knew that there were some ideas that were original and some that were predictable, and I thought my job was to have a new idea or to state something quote-unquote profound, you know. And I also had this idea that I was going to have this incredible, like an earthquake experience, you know, like I'd be in the Zendo and all of a sudden, the earth would rock and the sky would open, and I'd go in and go blah 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 blah, death and life, life and death. And he said, "That's brilliant. You're the next Dalai Lama. You know, where have you been, Lama Tulku? You know, I knew you would be reborn somewhere in the DC, in the New Jersey DC area. I found you." Really, I had that fantasy, you know, rediscovered, you know. Well, if Steven Seagal can do it, you know, why not me, you know? I was sure that was what he wanted, but as time went on, you know, I just got nowhere. You know, I just got nowhere, and I would get, you know, discouraged, because I wanted to be a success at Zen. I wanted to be successful, and I really wanted to be like a great Zen student, you know, like Joshu, or Zhao Zhou. I was a loser in Zen, you know, so to speak. I mean, my father used to tell me, "You don't be a loser." You know, he used to say, "There's only winners in this world." You know, blah blah blah. And he'd say, "There's no room for number two. You've got to be number one." You know, and those lessons, as I was saying, you know, they stuck in my head. So, you know, when Genki Roshi came to Seattle, he was like a little rock star, you know, like, you know, really like 60 people would show up on a Saturday for Taisho, you know. The room would be packed, and there'd be like people, "I must hear Taisho, Genki Roshi," you know. And then we had a sesshin, and the first sesshin, there must have been like 50 people there or more, you know. So I started with the class of 76, basically, you could say, or 75, 76, something like that. So anyway, I started with all these people who became my lifelong friends, you know. But, you know, we all got the breath perception koan, and then basically Genki would, you know, people would do sesshins and things like that. You really shouldn't talk about your koans with other people, and I hope you will never talk about what I say in Dokusan to you, to others. You know, please don't do that. I swear to you, I never say anything about what people say to me in Dokusan to any person, any human being. You know, I never discuss it, you know, with anybody, you know. Please don't, you know. If you've already done it, it's okay, you know. But it's such a good idea to, you know, compare notes and did you pass your koan? No. Yes, I did. That's not good, you know. It's not healthy. Because it's not a competition, right? We're not in the competitive mindset is a sick mind, in my opinion. So please, you know, it's not a race, you know. But I had a sick mind, you know. So I was, you know, I wanted to be at the head of the class and so on. I basically was at the back of the class because everybody would go to sesshin and they'd go in and they'd go to see Genki Roshi, and they'd be in there for a long time, you know. they'd come out and they'd have a very serene look on their face, you know. And after sesshin, you know, sometimes people would say, "I passed the koan, you know, it was great, you know, another one," you know. And I'd think, "Another one, you know." If I am still doing, you know, really the years went by and I'm still working on the breath koan. And I was trying to find this other way of experiencing the world, and I fell into it, you know. But I thought I didn't. My preconceptions prevented me from appreciating it. So I mean, for some reason, practicing Zen for me was like heaven. Please don't get me wrong. My legs used to kill me. I mean, I still have pain in my legs. So if you think I don't, you're kidding yourself. But I used to just be in agony. It would be, and I mean, literally, I would come in, sit on Sesshin. I would sit down on the cushion, and it would just be, I would just be like one breath ahead of my pain for the whole sit, you know. And then there'd be a break, and I'd down cross my legs, and then, you know, put them back up, and or in those days I used to just, you know, I didn't sit full lotus at all, you know. I, you know, so I just stretch my legs out and have a breather, and then put them back on the mat, and then you know, just one step ahead of the pain, and then the bell would ring, and we'd have a rest period, and I would just run to my bed, dive in, and you know, and try to recover enough strength, you know, enough strength for the next sit. You know, my roommate would wake me up, and we'd go in, and then it's all the same thing. And I mean, I slept, and that's a good strategy, you know. But in spite of the fact that I had a lot of pain, and in spite of the fact that my failure to answer my koan caused me a lot of psychological distress, you know, a lot of psychological distress, it really bothered me, and it was something I worried about, you know, and it was something that troubled me. Even though that was true, there was something about Zen that I just loved. And if you had asked me, well, what is it, I don't think I could have told you. But, you know, we were on our way to a sesshin once on a, we used to have our sesshins over in a place called the Hood Canal. And it was a beautiful location over a body of water, which is not really a canal, it's a channel. It's a natural formation. And it was beautiful. And we would do sesshin in a place that was not much different from this, really. You know, it didn't belong to us, we rented it. And we used to have to take a ferry, a boat, over to the island, where it was Bainbridge Island. And we would take the ferry, and I was riding over with somebody in our sangha, Abby Terrace was her name. And she said, I don't know what it is about Zen, but I just feel like I've been looking for this all my life. And I feel like I'm a thirsty person who's finally had a drink of water. And it was like, wow, that's it. You know, that's exactly right. And that's just how I feel, you know. It's just like I feel like I've been crazy, you know. I didn't know about Zen when I was five, but now that I started practicing Zen, I felt like I've been wanting this all my life, you know, all my life. And anyway, you know, I just loved the practice of Zen, even though I wasn't very good at it, apparently, you know. And I worked on the breath koan for literally years. Everybody else was like, it was like being in the first grade while everybody else is getting their high school diploma, you know. And all the same, something was happening inside me that I didn't, I was being changed by this process, but it wasn't visible to my little mind, you know, it wasn't visible. And I was sitting on the cushion and I was entering samadhi. Sometimes I really would be in deep samadhi and I'd feel like a million bucks. But when I'd go to Dokusan, I'd think, what am I going to say in Dokusan? You know, if I had just gone into Dokusan and said, you know, I sat down on the cushion this morning and my face and my hands disappeared and I felt like I was floating in space, Genki would have said, great, you know, now your reward is another koan, you know, on to the mu koan. And that was happening to me, but I just thought, well, this is not it. I'm waiting for the sky to open. I'm waiting for the, you know, the voice of the, you know, of the universe to speak words to me, you know. You know, left is right, up is down, you know, whatever, you know. And so I was missing the real change because my little mind only knew to look for, you know, philosophical statements or, but the change was very deep, you know. This is true throughout your practice, you know. When you're working on koans, you might think, you know, if I give you a koan, you know, you take the koan, you go back to the cushion, and you sit, and if you're able to enter a mushin, your mind is blank, and you're sitting there, and you're saying, you know, hot water, cold water, hot water, cold water, hot water, cold water. And, you know, you're waiting for the something to arise. And day one, nothing arises. You know? Day two, nothing arises. Day three, nothing arises. Day four, you think, well, I've got to say something. You know, so you go into Dokusan and you say, you know, I'd had a drink of cold water or something like that. You know, and no, sorry, not it. You know, so day five, you know, you say, well, I really was listening to the insects outside today. Great, wonderful, but that's not the answer. You know, so and then the session is over, and then another session comes, and it's hot water, cold water, hot water, cold water, hot water, cold water. You know, and you're, you know, day four, nope. Day five, nope. Day six, nope. Day seven, nope. You know. Next session, you know, no, sorry, keep going, you're doing a great job, but no, you know. Okay. And you think, you know, nothing is happening. Nothing, you know, this is crap, you know, I'm getting nowhere. But please don't, I mean, first of all, you know, Zen is not everybody's cup of tea, you know? So, you know, if people decide they don't want to do Zen practice, I don't take it personally, and it doesn't hurt my feelings, you know. I had a student who studied with me for 10 years and just decided he didn't want to do Zen anymore, you know. And I promise you, I mean, I love this person very much, but I didn't feel like, you know, I didn't feel personally injured or offended or, you know, I understand that a person might, you know, get something out of this practice and not want to continue to go on. So anytime anybody wants to stop practicing, it's okay with me, really. You know, so you should never, so I'm not trying to sell you on Zen, you know. And I'm not trying to convert you to Buddhism, whatever that would be. So I'm just telling you that if your heart is telling you to practice, if your heart is saying practice, then you shouldn't listen too much to your little mind, which is saying, I'm getting nowhere. You know, please don't listen to that little mind, because it doesn't know anything, right? All it knows is, you know, 2 + 2 = 4, the capital of New Jersey is Trenton, right? You know, so on. That's what it knows, right? But it doesn't know a lot about reality, and it doesn't know a lot about what's happening inside you. So all the time you're quote-unquote failing to answer your koan, you're going into deep mushin and you're internalizing this koan, and it's doing its work on an unconscious level. And this is the truth. This is the truth. You know, it's purifying body, mind, and heart. And when the little mind looks at the big mind, all it sees is a blank wall. So all the action, so to speak, takes place on the unconscious level. But it does happen. It does happen. You know, events, things can happen to you in ordinary, everyday life that have a deep, unconscious significance. So, you know, some of you have heard about this term trauma, right? So sometimes children have experiences which might not be particularly terrible, but they're traumatized by them. So, it could be terrible, but they're not, you know, that you wouldn't think they would have such a powerful impact. So, for example, when my mother was a little girl, she had a cat on the farm where they lived, and her cat's name was Aphrodite. Isn't that a great name for a cat? I loved my mother so much, I have to tell you. She named her cat Aphrodite, and her cat got run over by my grandfather's truck by accident, which could happen, you know, farm, it's a busy place, you know. So my mother, I think that was like traumatic for my mother. I think that event haunted her. And when we were little kids, we wanted to have a pet in the worst way. And my mother would always go, no pets, you know. And finally she got over it, you know. We did get a pet. But I think she didn't want, you know, there was a kind of fear that lingered, you know. So that's like that's an unconscious process, right? You know, an event enters the unconscious and it creates barriers, right? But it can work the other way too. You know, in other words, something can enter your unconscious and unlock the barriers. See, unlock the barriers. I was reading this article about this Cambodian man who was living in like Chicago. He was a refugee from Cambodia. And he was worried that all the Cambodian kids in their community were getting into crime. And he and the monk at their temple tried to create a garden. And they found some land in their neighborhood that wasn't used, and they planted plants, you know, like tomatoes and you know, other vegetables. And they got all the kids working in the garden. And the crime rate went down to nothing, you know. Because these kids were caring for something, right? They had to water, they put the seed in the ground or the little plant, and they watered it, and they came in the tent, and you know, they were concerned about their plant, and they weeded carefully. And this has a deep unconscious effect in so many ways, right? You know. So this also, you know, they have brought animals into prisons and had people who are you know, rather serious criminals have to take care of an animal. And of course, they often have never been asked to take care of anything in their lives. And all of a sudden this compassion arises in them. Because they have to care for an animal who is vulnerable, right? And under their power. And often, you know, criminals are really people who feel powerless and they're lashing out. And of course, our society makes people feel very powerless indeed. So actually having to care for an animal who's utterly under your power can produce great compassion. And again, this is well documented, that this has a transformative effect. Well, you know, Zazen, it does its work in the same way. It has a deep transformative effect on an unconscious level. And if you ask those kids who are planting plants in the field, are you changing? You know, what are you talking about? You know, I have to water the plants, you know. But are you becoming a better person? You know, I mean, that would just be, wouldn't make any, who knows. But indeed, they become better people. If you interviewed the criminals who are taking care of these dogs and cats, you know, they might not be aware of any change in themselves, but one day they would be a very different person. And koans work like that. They work on this deep, unconscious level. Probably if you've been practicing Zen for a while, you've already seen a change in yourself. If you keep going, the point of koan training isn't to answer the koan. It's to become a Buddha, right? It's to become a totally compassionate person. We can't will ourselves to be compassionate, you know. You can't say, okay, I'm going to be more compassionate tomorrow. You know, it's like if you have a bad temper, you can't say, that's it, no more bad temper, right? You know, the next day, something's going to set you off and you're going to be enraged and then you're going to feel guilt and so on. So changing even a little change takes time. The goal of Zen practice is to become a Buddha. So this is like the loftiest goal, right? So you might want to become a doctor or a lawyer or a president of the United States, and these are worthy goals. But in my opinion, becoming a Buddha is much higher goal. And that's much harder than becoming the president. Just look at the president. It's not really a fair comparison. But the point is, it's a lofty goal. So if you want to, you want to practice Zen just to be a little better person, that's wonderful. If you're practicing Zen because you want to wake up, then you've set yourself a very high standard, and I hope you pursue it. You know? If you do, I'm at your disposal 24 hours a day. Really. You can call anytime, or you can come by anytime. I'm at your disposal, absolutely. So don't be discouraged if you aren't, quote unquote, answering your koan. That's a very small mind way of experiencing the situation. You're changing every day by doing this practice. You're purifying body, mind, and heart. And failing to answer the koan is not a sign that you are a bad person, or that you're a loser or something. All human beings have countless obstacles, and so when we're working on the koan, if I could give you a koan and you could answer it in a day, it wouldn't be any good. See, I mean, it wouldn't be any good. If I could give you a koan and you'd sit down, bang, got it. You know, that, what good would that be? Because your obstacles would still be there. I'm looking for those devilishly clever koans, right? That are going to make you sweat on the cushion, see? And encounter your obstacles. I'm looking for the ones that are going to create a wall for you. Because that's a good teacher. A good teacher gives you the koans that make you sweat it out, see? And so I'm searching, always looking for those really difficult koans. You know, there's no value in a koan. If you could answer it this afternoon, there'd be no value. Remember that, you know. So when you get stuck in a koan, and if you do Zen training, you're going to get stuck, man. The months are going to go by, maybe years. There are some koans that take years, besides the mu koan. You know, so. You know, if you're stuck, this is wonderful. I mean, this is what it's all about. This is the Zen life. This is the Zen life. No, but it's wonderful. See, the goal is to be Buddha. You know, so you know, anything. You know, we're not going to stop. You know, even after Daikensho, you don't stop practicing. See, you will meet people who misunderstand this. And they've encountered, they've had a Daikensho, a great awakening experience. And then because they didn't have good teachers, in my opinion, they think, well, I'm done. You know, I'm Buddha now. You know, I say, well, no, not at all. Still have all this karma, this residual karma you have to clean up. Get to work, back to the cushion. See, and you might think, well, that's a hell of a thing, you know. I thought I was going to be able to get, stop doing this, you know. But, you know, I mean, I personally love Zen. You know, I can't wait. I mean, I hate to tell you this, but I wish we weren't leaving, you know. I mean, that's the truth. I got up this morning thinking, bummer. This is it. It's day five. Damn it. I hate these 5 days. No. I was disappointed. I was thinking, now I'm just getting into the groove. You know, I'm just getting into my stride, you know. But it never stops. And if that seems like a terrible thing, just forget about it for now. But eventually, the more the barrier, it always feels good when a barrier drops, right? When a barrier drops and your heart opens up, you know, and tears might run down your face. Everything is so fresh and clean. It's like, oh man, I love this feeling. I love this feeling, right? I love that feeling. And so this barrier goes down, and then you sweat it out, and this barrier goes down, and the world gets bigger, 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 more alive, more alive, more alive. I think that's great. Why would you want to stop? Really, why would you want to stop? I mean, if you want to stop, it's okay. No, but I mean, as I say, you know, not everybody's cut from the same bowl of cloth, you know. I mean, I don't go around thinking, well, he doesn't do Zen. He's, you know. I meet people all the time who have followed other paths. Like my doctor. I have a doctor, Dr. Gandotra, who's a wonderful human being. He works from dawn till dusk. I mean, he's in his office. I'm afraid he's going to have a heart attack or something, you know. Being a doctor, that's actually hard work because, you know, we have a good relationship because, of course, I mean, I do Zazen, I get exercise, I'm a vegetarian. You know, I come in, he does the blood pressure, my blood pressure is like 100 over 55, or 95, or, you know, and we have a nice conversation. But, you know, and then I go out in the room and, you know, basically, there's all these sick people out here, you know, and they're all sick. And all day long, you have sick people come in, and they're, you know, he works with older people, too, you know, so he has a lot of geriatric patients, and they need help coming into the room. This is wonderful, right? But, you know, I think psychologically it's difficult all day long, you know, sick people, you know. So I have real reverence for my doctor. He's a wonderful human being, you know. So I understand, you know, he hasn't done Zen, you know, I understand that. That's not his path in life. So I don't have contempt or something for people who say, gee, I've loved this Zen practice, but I think I want to do something else with the rest of my life. I'm so grateful to have helped you, yeah? But on the other hand, if you're the kind of person who loves this or just speaks to you, you know, then why would you want to stop, you know? And one other thing, I know I'm going on for a long time, but, you know, But this is a subject I care a lot about. You know, so, this whole issue of the wrong answer. You know, if you're facing Mushin, and you're sitting deeply and you're saying, hot water, cold water, and something pops into your head, or you notice something, right, and you come in to see me and you say, you know, I was listening to the crickets today, you know. In a certain sense, there are some answers that aren't wrong answers. You know, or let me put it this way. If you're doing that, there isn't a wrong answer. There's not a wrong answer. It's just keep engaging with the koan, and your perception gets deeper, deeper, more focused, you know. So, you know, people come in sometimes and they give me an answer which is actually, it's like looking at something from a distance, right? It's like, you might see something in the distance and you say, oh my gosh, I think that's a, you know, I think that's a pagoda, you know? And then you walk a little farther and you realize it's not a pagoda, it's a skyscraper. You just were, at a distance, you thought it was one thing. As you get closer, you see more clearly. And then you get even closer and you see the particular details. Well, a lot of koan practice is like that, you know. It's like you'll sit on the cushion and you'll come up with an answer and you'll come in and I'll say, well, keep working. And you think, oh, you know, that was a wrong answer. But that's not quite how it works. It's like you're very far from seeing it clearly. I hope that makes it some sense. But that doesn't mean you're not seeing something important. It's just keep going. When I say go deeper, I mean, you know, walk a little farther toward it and see what you see. So originally it might look like, you know, this, and then you get closer and it looks quite different. And then you get closer and it looks quite different. So the answers you give might be, there's a progression. So this issue of you think, oh, I gave my answer was wrong. It's not quite how it works. It's more like as the koan goes into your unconscious, it begins to grip you. It begins to transform you. And as it transforms you, you start giving answers, so-called, you're going through a process. And you come in and you say, it's this. And I say, great. Keep going, and now you're transformed a little more. It's like, have you ever gone, if you wear glasses, I'm sure you have, you go in for an eye exam, right? And the guy puts this big thing on your, like a giant pair of glasses with changeable lenses, right? He puts them over your eyes. I think they, you know, still do that. But basically, maybe they don't anymore. Maybe they use a computer, but my doctor is older than I am, so he has an old-fashioned system. And you go in and he puts on this big machine on your nose, and then he starts flipping lenses. He goes, how is this any better? And you're looking, upside down, right, you know. So read those and you go, A, B, C, O, you know. And then he flips them, and is this any better? No, that's worse. And then, okay. Well, this is like koan practice, right? It's like you're looking and you know, as you change, it's like you put on another pair of glasses. So you're going through this change and you look with these glasses and it's all blurry and you say, it looks like, this. Okay, go back and you go do some more sitting and you're changing. And it's like all of a sudden you have a new pair of glasses and you look again and it looks quite different this time. And then, so it's like you're putting on glasses as you go through this process and you're getting sharper, sharper, sharper image. So this is quite different, see, from I got it or I didn't get it. You know, oh, another wrong answer. You know, that's like, you think back to all the tests you took where, you know, don't I get points for doing the math right, even though the, you know, result is wrong? Don't I get some points, you know? No points, you know? How about effort? Can I pass a koan because of effort? You know, that's not taken into consideration here. But don't think in those terms. You know, you have to be in blank mind. You're calling the koan, and stuff starts happening. See, stuff's popping up, and that's exactly right. That's how it's supposed to go. And if you're you're just starting engaging with the koan. At first, when you're starting to work with the koan, nothing's popping up, right? Because it takes some time for it to soak in. So it's nothing's happening. And it might take a while, but it's doing its work. And then you start noticing something, or things pop up, and you become aware of this or that. You start coming into the dokusan, and this is like putting on the better and better glasses, right? And so it's not a simple yes or no proposition. You're going through a process that's taking you somewhere. and it's to a place where the barrier is going to fall down and you're going to encounter some aspect of reality with great intensity sometime. And, but sometime, you know, you don't know what the heck you've done. You know, sometimes you answer the call and I go, wonderful, wonderful, and you think, I didn't even know that was the right answer. You know, but that it comes from basically, you know, basically I have a different perspective on all this. You know, the Buddha used to talk about, you know, Zen practice or meditation practice as being like the blind man and the elephant. So, you know, basically each blind man grabs a different part of the elephant and says, you know, an elephant is like a snake, an elephant is like a tree, an elephant is like, you know, is like a sheep, you know, an elephant is like a leaf, you know, they're each holding a banana leaf, you know, each holding a different part of the elephant. Well, this is just like Zen practice, you know, so you might be working on a koan, and at the end of it I go, great! And you think, great, what is this? You know, what does this mean? And please don't even think about what it means. It's just like you found the toenail, right? You know, you found the tail. You found, you know, the left leg. You found, eventually it's all going to fit together into an elephant. Really. I mean, the Buddha's got the right idea, you know. Now, surprisingly. you just don't worry about it all fitting together. Don't, whatever you do, don't try to figure it out. Don't come up with a system. Just be blank and empty and go through the trust in the process. And you know, remember, when you get discouraged, that's your small mind talking, right? Your small mind. You know, once I got so discouraged because I wasn't getting anywhere with my Zen practice, I was going to go to Rohatsu, the winter sashin, and I didn't go. And I went up to British Columbia, to Vancouver, British Columbia. And I thought, you know, I'm going to have a good time, you know. And I was under pressure to go too, actually. I was, you know, basically being pressured not to go to sashin. And I thought, well, you know, I'm not getting anywhere with sashin. You know, I sit on a cushion and I just get nothing back. So, great. And I went up there and, you know, basically I went out to dinner and I went to movies and, you know, I was miserable the whole time. You know, I was so unhappy. It was so clear. I mean, I was like burning with unhappiness. And I thought to myself, you know, when I'm miserable in the Zendo, I'm happier than I am right now. And that's the truth. You know, when I'm miserable on the cushion, I'm happier than I am, you know, in a movie, in a good restaurant, because, you know, as I say, it's not everybody's cup of tea, but, you know, I love this Zen practice. I love this path. So, you know, if you love it, don't get discouraged. No, don't get discouraged. Oh yes, hunting and pecking. Well, you're tapping from the outside. See? It's like, you know, sometimes a mother hen will peck at an egg to help the chick out. See? We're like the chick. Right? We're trapped in the egg and we're trying to get out, right? And we think, God, I'll never get out of this damn egg, you know, this damn shell, you know? And, oh man, I'm no good, I can't peck my way out, you know? This shell is too thick, you know, who designed this shell? This is so unfair, you know? My life is so unfair, you know? And what a scam this whole thing is. And you think, but you know, meanwhile, Mother Hen is pecking on the other side to help us. See? And your big mind is like your Mother Hen, you know? It's the whole universe is trying to help you wake up. And you can't see it because you're in the egg, and in the shell, I should say. But, right, you know, the Mother Hen who loves you dearly is trying to help you. So, you know, help is on the way. You know, believe me, and it's your big mind is going to come to your rescue, honestly. Just trust it.